not only did he have a relationship with the government, but he had a role in the FBI. In this world, you look out for number one. Few, if any, people take that oath to the grave. These guys are on the street, so they're involved in hustling.
So we want to welcome into the OG podcast, Harry Boris. Harry was a club owner in Boston. He owned the legendary Channel Rock Club in South Boston. It's a club that was very prominent throughout the 1980s, and it was synonymous with the city of Boston's rock and roll scene in a way that, you know, in New York, you had CBGBs. In LA, you had, you know, the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Troubadour, the Roxy. Well, in Boston, you had the Channel. And we're here with Harry Boris to talk a little bit about his time as owner of the Channel and then his run-ins with some Massachusetts mafia figures. So, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, how you doing?
Good, man. We really appreciate you coming on the OG with us. How prevalent was the mafia or the what they call in Boston the patriarch of crime family? You know, was it something you were aware of as a young kid growing up in Jamaica Plains, or wasn't until you became an adult where you kind of were aware of their presence?
Well, no. Everybody knew the Angiulo family, and they owned a lot of buildings, and everybody kind of talked about the Angiulo brothers, and they were branches of the Patriarca family in Providence. You know, Raymond Patriarca was supposedly the head of the underworld, and everybody knew who he was. It was in the news often. You know, he was kind of like accepted as the godfather, but for some reason they never really, you know, got him. The same with the Angiulos, and they were it was an open secret in Boston that the Angiulos ran the crime scene in Boston, as far as I can remember, early 60s. And, you know, finally they were taken down thanks to wiretaps that, you know, Whitey Bulger and John Connolly had arranged. But for the most part, the Angiulos reigned in Boston and everybody knew about it. I mean, my father worked in the restaurant business and he used to talk about the Angiulos coming in and, you know, being VIPs and everything. So it was very much known. I mean, Whitey was a little bit different. Whitey was, I think, at least at the beginning, he was a little under the radar. You know, he was very well known in South Boston. You know, there was a mythology that he kept South Boston clean from drugs and stuff like that. But
well, that couldn't be further from the truth. We all know now, you know, 30 years later, that he was actually flooding the streets of South Boston with drugs.
And people in the city knew that. You know, they knew that he was. But, you know, it's like South Boston, you know, unlike JP, where I grew up, which is Jamaica Plain, was very white and mostly Irish, and you know, you didn't really see much diversity there. The city was very insular and very closed. You know, the town, it wasn't a city, it's a neighborhood. It was, you know, quite a difference from where I grew up. But I had no problem going into South Boston, and we used to go to the parade every year. Whitey was a known figure. We'd seen him. You know, he walked along South Boston there by the viaduct where the ships come in, and he walked along there. I used to walk in the same place. I'd see him once in a while, and he always kind of, you know, nodded hello. So he wasn't, like, invisible at all.
So kind of talk about how you got into the nightclub business and wanting to create a music venue that you ended up creating in the Channel, which, you know, obviously became pretty iconic. But how did you get into the business, and then how did you conceive the idea of the Channel?
I was in the food and beverage business. I owned a couple of restaurants, you know, one successful, one not so much. I worked as a manager in different places. So I got a job as a manager in a big Boston disco called Jason's. I worked there in the restaurant, not the disco, for a while. And I saw the nightclub business. I liked it, but I hated the whole scene. I hated the disco. I hated the cocaine, the limousines. You know, a lot of mobsters used to come in. I really liked the nightclub business because I saw an opportunity to make a good sum of money without having to do a lot of heavy lifting. But I hated disco. I hated the superficial music. I hated the people. I hated the cocaine culture. And, you know, when I left there, I was on the lookout for either a job or an opportunity to you know, I saw a lot of Boston music, a lot of very up-and-coming music, you know, that really had very little places to play. There was a couple of small clubs. it's just like there was so much talent, you know, besides the big guys, you know, Aerosmith and Boston and Cars and Jay Giles and everything else. There was, you know, dozens, hundreds, actually, of local bands that were really good. And I saw that they had no place to play. The Paradise was the only place that gave them a chance, and the shows were, it was more like a theater setting than a nightclub setting. I just thought that there was a need for something that was a little bit more earthy, a little more raw, a little bit more in-your-face rock and roll. And I went in there, and I was able to kind of, you know, along with a couple of friends, was able to buy, you know, a share in it. It was tough to go to begin with because it was in South Boston. In South Boston, you know, our guiding principles was diversity, meaning that we were trying to get all kinds of music, you know, everything from rock to blues to rap to punk to everything.
Reggae? Didn't you have some reggae bands through there?
A lot of reggae bands. Steel Pulse, The Wailers, Jimmy Cliff, UB40, dozens, Mutu Baruka, Yellow Man.
Would you say that most of your audience members were coming from outside of Southie as a result, or was it a mix?
We were in Southie, but we were on the fringes of Southie.
I see.
Were just, you know, we were right over the bridge, and they were, you know, they called it the Ford Point neighborhood, but it wasn't much of a neighborhood. So most of our, 95% of our audience came from the city.
What were some of the rock bands, punk rock bands, that were coming up at that time that would play the channel?
Well, there was a couple of bands in Boston, like Gangrene.
Oh, yeah, I remember them.
Yeah. You know, so there's Husker Du, Sonic sure. Youth, Buzzcocks, Dead Kennedys, which we have advertised,
wow.
DKs, because yeah. they were offensive.
Right. What kind of guy was Jello from DK, from Dead Kennedys?
He was crazy.
That makes sense from what I know.
He was crazy.
That's interesting.
They're all characters. They have to be. You know, they have to have a big ego, and they're all characters. After a while, you kind of, you know, get immune to them. You just kind of, like, roll your eyes back and just kind of deal with them, you know?
Sure. Were there any particular heavy metal groups that come to mind during that same era that you were giving, opportunity
heavy,
to?
Heavy metal, we did Metallica, Motorhead, Pantera.
Wow.
Winger. There was a lot. I mean, Extreme, which wasn't really a metal band, but they actually became big. They started off being kind of like a metal band.
Sure.
Even though they were kind of more known by the mainstream for ballads.
That's right. That's how, right. Yeah. Later on, that's what they became known for, right?
I guess, you know, metal was kind of the thing that we were recognized by UHF as one of the great clubs in the world. But, you know, metal was a small part of our repertoire. I mean, we did everything.
Yeah, what about the kind of the glam scene of the 1980s? You know, I guess you could call, like, hair rock with the Motley Crue's and the Poisons. Did you have any of those guys come through?
A couple of those guys. I don't even remember what they were called, but they did very well. But I can't remember what they were called. But the hair bands, you know.
Did some of the more nationally known acts, did they start hanging out at the channel even though they weren't performing there necessarily?
Oh, yeah. We had, you know, we used to have people hanging out there all the time. There were, you know, the Boston so-called big stars like, you know, Tyler. And, I mean, Perry used to play there
wow.
at the channel when Aerosmith had broken up.
Oh, right. You and the Joe Perry Project.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And with Charlie Farron. So he used to, you know, we used to actually, we hired his ex-wife, Alyssa, as a cocktail waitress.
Wow.
And she was a famous lady of rock and roll. They wrote the song, Sweet Emotion, about her.
Right.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's Alyssa, very famous rock and roll life.
Yeah.
Alyssa used to work at the club, and my brother used to be the manager, and he used to fire her about once a week. And she'd always come to me, and she'd tell me, Adrian really needs food. Your brother just fired me. So he used to fire her because she was a terrible waitress. And I would always hire her back.
That's a great story.
We had a little history, me and Alyssa, you know. But we used to, you know, everybody, you know, Joe Strummer came in when the Clash was playing
sure.
in town. Jimmy Page came in one time, and we actually had to give him a bomber jacket, a Channel jacket, because he asked for it.
Wow!
But my daughter was running the concession stand at the time. She says, "That's Jimmy Page. You can pay for it."
He's got enough money.
That's great.
Exactly.
That's true.
He wears that, you know. It's okay. But, you know, they all hang on. Rico Kasich and, you know, Peter Wolf. And, you know, they all came in because they used to kind of shop local bands. A lot of the local bands. I mean, our bread and butter was local bands to begin with. And then, you know, and we had a lot of resistance from the local big promoter. You know, so we had a struggle to get national acts. Sometimes we had to overpay. Sometimes we had to overpromise. And a lot of times we had to fight a little bit, including in court sometimes. So it was a struggle. I mean, we had one incident, which I'll tell you very quickly. In 1982, we were really struggling to get national acts. You know, sometimes we wouldn't even get avails. But we found somebody that was talking to us about the B-52s, right? They said, yeah, you want the B-52s? Yeah. So, okay, it's going to cost you $20,000. This is in 82 now, when 20 grand was a lot of money. And, you know, we have a date on I think it was a Wednesday night, a week from this Wednesday, so a week later. One stipulation, you can't advertise the show. Take it or leave. Take it or leave it. You got to come up with $10,000 today, wire to the agency. And if we advertise it in print or radio, the show's going to be canceled. We're going to forfeit our deposit. So we put the show on sale. We couldn't advertise it. We asked Mark Parente from WBCN to kind of just mention it in the afternoon. He did. We sold out. Made 10 grand on the deal.
Did Mark Parente hang out at the club a lot?
Yeah. Not only he hung out there, but he's the kind of MC shows once in a while, too.
Now, if a Steven Tyler or Joe Perry walks into the club, or Jimmy Page even, I mean, do they come in alone? Do they come in with an entourage? Do they come in with several, like, bodyguard, big guys? Like, who's looking out for them?
Steven Tyler used to come in with a couple of big guys. Okay, but they would fade into the background, but you knew they were with him. Jimmy Page, as far as I know, came in with a couple of guys, but he was pretty much kind of trying, you know, he was kind of under the radar. He didn't really want to be recognized too much. And somebody had to tell us that that was him. I didn't know. I didn't even notice him. So most of them did not come in with an entourage. So, you know, they pretty much came in kind of like, you know, and we didn't really make a big deal out of them. We had, you know, we didn't have bouncers. We had security people. We didn't really, you know, try to intimidate people and everything. For the most part, everybody was left alone.
As synonymous as the Channel Rock Club was with South Boston, is as synonymous as Whitey Bulger was with that neighborhood. Can you kind of talk about your, you know, the first time you ever heard the name Whitey Bulger?
Whitey Bulger was kind of in the news ever since the Winter Hill Gang, you know, with Howie Winter and Somerville and everything. And he was kind of like, considered, you know, he had been in jail. I mean, I think he was in Alcatraz when he was younger. So, you know, and then, of course, his brother was an up-and-coming politician. He ended up becoming Senate president and then the president of UMass Boston. Actually, I think the whole UMass system, you know, he had a plum job, you know, that Mitt Romney kind of fired him from. So everybody knew Whitey. Whitey was Whitey. I mean, everybody knew he was a wise guy. Everybody knew he had served time in jail. He was coming back, and he was working with Howie Winter at Winter Hill, and he kind of asserted himself in South Boston. And you know, when I first went into the Channel, one of the first encounters I had was with a bunch of South Boston toughs who threw his name around. You know, and said, you know, that, oh, you better hire us to help you take care of things, or Whitey's going to, you know. But I knew better. I knew that if Whitey wanted to send any kind of a message, he would have done it himself. You know, so we would never, I mean, for, you know, I don't know why Whitey never removed it on us. I mean, I asked the guy that I was working with, the FBI, you know, why, and he really couldn't tell me, even if he could. I don't think he would.
Just to clarify for the listeners, so Whitey never tried to extort your club, despite the fact that he was extorting anyone and everyone he could, business-wise, drug dealer-wise, criminal-wise, legitimate business-wise in South Boston. But for some reason, you were able to avoid that. Whitey never tried to extort the club.
I wouldn't say that he was extorting all the businesses. I mean, South Boston is a pretty big place, and he, you know, he did, you know, drive a guy, you know, there was a liquor store he wanted, so he just kind of forced the guy out. And, you know, a few other, yeah, I mean, he used to, you know, get a cut on drug deals and everything else. But I don't know that he had an influence in every business in South Boston or even most businesses. He never bought us. I mean, you know, I heard his name three or four times. I actually used to see him on Castle Island, where there's a place where you can walk. And just, you know, he just kind of nodded and he just nodded. You know, it's not like he was ever an intimidating figure, even though we used to hear that he was, you know, that he was a bad guy. We just figured, you know, hey, we stay out of their way, they stay out of our way, you know. And then I thought, you know, at some point, this other Boston mobster tried to make a move on the channel in the mid-'80s, and we basically pretty much, you know, fended him off.
And that was Vinny the Animal Ferrara, correct?
Yeah. And then so I thought, you know, in retrospect, that maybe because because Ferrara was with the Angiulos, right?
And yeah, Vinny Ferrara was a protege of Jerry Angiulo in an East Boston gangster by the name of J.R. Russo.
Yeah, and that's why I thought maybe that may have been a reason why Whitey, because Whitey at the time was spying on the Angiulos, I think, and maybe the FBI told him to stay away because this might have been, you know, I really don't know, and I actually was gonna, the day before Whitey died, you know, we were trying to get a hold of his attorney to see if he'd agreed to either answer an email or talk to us. You know, but you know, it didn't work out, obviously.
Talk
I was going to ask him. He was 89 years old. I figured he might tell me why.
Talk a little bit about the end, when you kind of decided at the end of the 80s to get out of the business and you started negotiations to sell it to a local businessman, attorney, real estate developer, mob associate named Stevie DeSaro.
You know, in the late 80s, early 90s, I just got sick of selling alcohol. I just wanted to be in the entertainment business, and I didn't want to sell booze. And I thought I could do it, and I wanted to do it. So I decided I just wanted to sell my share of the club, and my brother decided he wanted to sell too. And so we owed two-thirds of it, and we decided we'd sell two-thirds to the other partner, and plus DeSaro, and our lawyer at the time, you know, was going to be part of the group. It was going to be like the legal for small shares. So basically, DeSaro brought in a guy that supposedly had a lot of money, and I kind of checked him out, and he did. He was an electrical contractor from Providence. And
that was Frank, you know, Zamiello, right?
Yeah.
Who was a mob associate in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah. But, I mean, I found out that he was a legitimate electrical contractor. Marullo, you know, who's our lawyer, said, hey, he's good for it, and he's going to give me a check. And I said, fine. And so basically, on Marullo's and DeSaro's advice, we filed Chapter 11 because we owed some taxes and we had some slip and falls that we had to deal with. And we filed Chapter 11, and, you know, based on the fact that I thought we had, you know, a escrow money to buy the club, I let DeSaro pretty much run the place because my brother was kind of like through with being the night manager. He didn't want to do it. So I said, fine, you run the place.
Did you realize at this time, well, I'm sorry to interject, but did you realize at this time that Stevie DeSaro had a silent partner behind him in addition to Frank Zamiello named Cadillac Frank Salemi, who at that point had replaced the Angiulos as the mob boss of not just Boston, but of all of New England. And they were silent partners with DeSaro. Did you know that?
No. As a matter of fact, after you know, we kind of made a deal with him and he started, you know, coming into the club and running the club and transitioning, he brought in Frank Jr. and he introduced him. He said, here's my money guy. Okay. So I said, who's this? So I knew kind of, I had heard the name Frank Salemi, Cadillac Frank. And DeSaro says, hey, his father's a mobster, but that's okay. But, you know, Bulge's brother is a senator. So it's not like you can't condemn him because his father's a mobster. So I said, look, as long as the money's good and the deal is good, I don't give a shit who your partner is. You want to do business with this guy, it's fine. I have no problem with that. And, you know, to tell you the truth, in all the time I was there, I never met a senior.
Never met Cadillac Frank. You met Frankie Boy, who was his son.
Frankie Boy, I had an encounter with him. You know, he basically challenged me to a gunfight.
And Frankie was a loose cannon, was a real wild card. And
he was a crazy person. Him and Whitey came in one night, And I was, you know, and he's like throwing his weight around and everything else. And I asked him to just leave. And he basically challenged me to a gunfight. And I said, look, I fight with lawyers, not with guns. I said, I don't do guns. I don't own one. I don't know how to use one. I said, I don't fight with guns. I fight with lawyers. I said, call your lawyer. I'll call mine. That's what I did. You know, so I thought, you know, at that time, I kind of figured out that this kid was a crazy person. You know, and then, you know, slowly things fell apart.
Did Frankie Boy's behavior, though, the way that he was throwing his weight around, in lieu of the fact that you thought Stevie DeSaro was really in the driver's seat, by Frank Jr. trying to assert himself more, did that kind of give you an inkling, or was that a red flag that things were kind of going off the rails in terms of the sale?
Yeah, of course. I thought things were going off the rail, and I think that, my lawyer was intimidated or, you know, threatened or whatever. And DeSaro was just, DeSaro was always, you know, he's always kind of trying to make a deal here or a deal there or talk. Just kind of, he was a very nervous person. You know, he used to get, you know, and one of the reasons why I think they were suspicious of him is because he used to kind of like, you know, do the whisper and the, you know, off to the side conversation and stuff like that. You know, he was always scurrying around, you know, acting suspiciously, you know.
What would you have said in, you know, so you started negotiating to sell the club, what, in 1990?
Yeah, 90 or 90, yeah, probably 90, 91. Yeah, probably the end of 90.
What would you have estimated that the true value of the club was at that point?
You know, our deal was, you know, for, you know, a few hundred thousand. You know, the value of the club was kind of tenuous because we didn't own that property. It was a lease. It was owned by Boston Wharf, and Boston Wharf was a very big development company in Boston, and they were not willing to give. I mean, we were there for 11 years, and I think it was 8 different leases because they were only giving you a 2-year lease at a time. So the value of the club was limited by the fact that we didn't have a lease, and very few locations could match that, you know, at the time, because, you know, there was other big clubs in Kenmore Square and other places where, you know, there was no parking, no access, and, you know, that place had everything. You know, no neighbors to complain for loud music and traffic, there was just a lot going for it.
The club itself was worth at least $250,000.
Oh, at least, yeah. It was worth, yeah, and we were going to get more than that just for our 2/3.
Okay, so then let's tell the listeners, what did DeSaro and the Salemis ended up getting the club for? What was the number?
According, you know, and this is something that I learned recently at the trial, they ended up buying the assets of the club on the in auction for $51,000.
To give a little primer for what happened after the club changed hands, to the listeners that aren't aware, that Stevie DeSaro and the Salemis took over the club from Harry and his partners, and pretty quickly thereafter they had to shut down the channel as a rock club, and they eventually regenerated the business as a strip club, but they were losing money pretty fast, and by the spring of 1993, the FBI and the IRS began sniffing around and looking at DeSaro and Salemi for using the club to launder illegal proceeds. The Salemis believed that Stevie DeSaro was going to cooperate, so they killed Stevie DeSaro in May of 1993. Fast forward to 2016, and the FBI digs up Stevie DeSaro's body in Providence, and Frank Salemi Sr., Cadillac Frank, goes on trial for that murder in the summer of 2018, and Harry had to testify at that trial.
No, I did not.
Oh, Harry, you did not testify.
I did not.
Your brother testified.
I had a subpoena. I had to be in court, but they didn't end up calling me.
Okay.
They called my brother, but they did not call me.
And then there was a little incident outside your brother's pizzeria in the days leading up to his testimony when a car was set on fire. It seemed like it could have been an intimidation tactic.
We thought so. You know, it was the day after Peter had been interviewed by the prosecutor and the FBI agent for the second time, and at the Cohasset Police Station. And the next day, so he that was done on an afternoon, I think a Friday afternoon, and that Friday morning, the next Saturday morning, like at 2 or 3 a.m., three cars actually went up in flames right outside his store, which is right down the street from my house. So we thought, you know, Salemi's history was kind of like car bombs and stuff like that, and we just thought maybe, you know, there might have been a connection, but the FBI pretty much said they thought it was a coincidence.
So the trial garnered a lot of headlines, not just in Boston, but nationwide. Eventually, Cadillac Frank was found guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison. And you're out there now trying to tell your story. Tell your story about the channel, about your experience working in the music business in Boston in the 1980s. Your experience dealing with the Salemis with the sale of the club. Kind of tell the listeners about what you got going on with an upcoming podcast that you're putting together.
Yeah, we're putting a podcast together called Boston Venue, and it's going to tell the pretty much the true and complete story of the channel. With some looks on the inside, you know, just the way that I saw and I experienced it. We'll be putting up a teaser soon, probably this week, and then we'll probably have our first episode in about 2 weeks after that, and then we're going to try to put one out every 2 weeks, and it's called Boston Venue, The Channel Story. And we also have a website called thechannelstory.com, which explains kind of the story behind the story, how the podcast is coming together, who the people involved are. You know, I'm trying to get people involved that were there, you know, especially music performers that were on stage and saw things.
That experienced it firsthand.
Yeah, exactly. We want to bring people back there and just have the real experience, you know. The channel was an emotional experience. We want to kind of try to reproduce that if we can.
Harry, this was awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Harry. Good luck with the podcast.
Okay, thank you.